Hello, and welcome to a special episode of First Fuel. On Tuesday this week, just hours before the 2020 federal budget, I hosted a panel that featured Anna Scarbeck from Climeworks Australia, Amanda McKenzie from the Climate Council, Eitan Lenko from Beyond Zero Emissions, Ian Learmonth from the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, and Kane Thornton from the Clean Energy Council. It was an online joint plenary to kick off the virtual editions of both All Energy Australia and Energy Efficiency Expo for 2020. And you won't be surprised to hear that we focused on the prospects for a clean and green economic recovery. And while the federal budget did not deliver a lot more direct investment in this space, I think the conversation remains deeply relevant as we look to the state budgets that will be delivered in coming months and the next federal budget that will be handed down in May 2021. I really enjoyed the chat. I hope you do too. So, to today's panel, Reed Exhibitions have assembled a who's who of clean energy today to discuss this crucial issue, how we hit the accelerator on a green economic recovery. I'm going to begin by introducing our panellists. We have Anna Scarbeck, CEO of Climeworks Australia, which is well known for producing some of the most authoritative and clearly communicated research on how we can decarbonise the Australian economy. Amanda McKenzie, CEO of the Climate Council, the independent climate change education and advocacy body founded in 2013 after a wildly successful crowdfunding campaign. Eitan Lenko, Executive Chair of Beyond Zero Emissions, a climate and energy solutions think tank focused on showing how Australia can thrive through a transition to zero emissions economy. Ian Learmonth, CEO of the CFC, Australia's Green Bank, who has more than 30 years' experience as a financier and investor across markets in Asia, Europe and Australia. And, of course, my good friend Kane Thornton, CEO of the Clean Energy Council, man who needs no introduction because he was already introduced around 10:30 a.m. So welcome to everybody. I've just got a couple of comments to tee things up. The first thing to say is that the discussion around a green recovery is not an Australian one. It's a global one. Back in June, the International Monetary Fund and the International Energy Agency released a special report on sustainable recovery, which highlighted the huge opportunity to create over 9 million jobs around the world and accelerate the structural changes in the economy that would start to seriously bend the curve on emissions. Of course, we've seen key governments act with Germany, France, Denmark, the UK, Canada and Chile all committing many billions of dollars to clean recovery measures, and the European Union as a whole has set aside over 570 billion euros for the cause. And most recently, we've seen Joe Biden put a clean recovery at the heart of his presidential campaign in the US, proposing US $1.7 trillion of spending over 10 years to transform the US economy. And all of these plans have taken the advice of the experts, the IEA and IMF and elsewhere, that putting energy efficiency upgrades of buildings and industry, as well as grid upgrades and, of course, the rollout of renewables needs to be at the centre of their plans. And we're certainly seeing that prosecuted by all of those nations. So, Amanda, it's Budget Day. It's been billed as the most important budget since the Second World War. And when I tuned into the radio this morning, there was a lot of talk of bang for the buck. Now, your plan, the Clean Jobs Plan, is kind of all about bang for the buck. It's based on your work with Alpha Beta, which ran the ruler over 30 clean recovery stimulus options and rated them for effectiveness based on three criteria. Can you take us through those criteria and why they are so important to consider when targeting stimulus dollars?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Luke. So this was published in July. And as Luke said, we did work with Alpha Beta to do modelling on the economy. We went to them and said, there are three areas of criteria that we want to analyse to find a list of jobs that can be created. It's not every job that can be created across the economy. These are jobs that need to be high impact, targeted and timely were the three criteria. So just to unpack that, high impact was really about jobs overall. So does it maximise the jobs that can be created per dollar invested? Does it add investment to the economy? Does it leverage funding from the private sector? So when you get into the detail of our report, you'll see all of the policy options that are identified. It identifies how the proportion of dollars that would be unlocked in the private sector. So unsurprisingly, utility scale renewables comes out high on that measure. For instance, we found that it would unlock every dollar of public investment unlocks another $3 of private investment. So that's the high impact piece. How many jobs does it create? The second piece is that it's targeted. So are jobs being targeted in the right industries and occupations? And our jobs being targeted at the right regions. So we were very concerned about making sure that there was a lot of jobs targeted to regional areas, but also jobs targeted to industries that have lost jobs that are unlikely to be gaining jobs as the economy just naturally goes back to normal, if you like. So some of the hospitality jobs, for instance, that we had hoped at this stage when we were publishing it, as has happened in most of Australia, a lot of those jobs have come back as the economy has opened in that way. So we were particularly focused around administration and construction, where there'd been 80,000 jobs lost at that point. And then we were looking at a range of different other areas where jobs have been lost, where it was unlikely to come back in that particular area. The other feature was timely, the third criteria. So can the program be scaled rapidly for immediate job creation? And does it create jobs in the medium and long term? So the jobs that are identified in this plan need to be created within 3 years, with as many as possible being in the first year. So we looked at jobs that required minimal training, for instance. So there's a large proportion in this plan that require either no training or very minimal sort of on-the-job training or less than 12 months training. So that gives you a sense of how we sort of broke it down to then find the 12 policy options and then say, well, which jobs do you sort of prioritise within those? So if you've had a chance to look at our report, right up the top, there's the key findings. And top line, we found that there was, through 12 different policy options, there were 76,000 jobs available that were available in a timely way, as I said, that could be both getting people into work and tackling climate change at the same time. And the big winners were utility scale renewables, as I said earlier. But ecosystem restoration also came out very strongly, particularly in Queensland, where there was 5,000 jobs that could be created in that area, which we've had some good conversations with the Queensland government and they have taken some initiatives in that area. There was also a range of opportunities in active transport, particularly for New South Wales, and then a range of other projects around organic waste, energy efficiency, urban green spaces, etc. We found that, as I mentioned, one in three jobs require minimal training. So it's really looking at displaced workers and where some of those regional jobs are that will be potentially hard to come back or will take a while to come back. So we're looking at sort of northern Queensland tourism, for instance, that has suffered a lot. Are there opportunities in that region? And then I mentioned the opportunities around particular areas that jobs were lost. And overall, 42% of job opportunities were identified for regional Australians. So that gives you a bit of a summary of the plan. It was quite granular economic modelling, and if you have a chance to have a look at it, you'll find that it goes through each of the 12 policy options with some detail around each, and then it goes through each of the states, again, looking at which are the most important policy options for each of those states.
Yeah, well, I want to congratulate you and the team on the report, Amanda. It was a really fantastic contribution, particularly because it was so careful to frame the conversation around clean energy stimulus in language that would resonate with Treasury departments. Yes. So thinking about those key metrics of how many jobs are created, the job multiplier, absolutely crucial at the moment, but also how quickly we can roll out these stimulus measures. In the context of stimulus, there are all kinds of things that we want to do over the next decade, but there's a subset of them that we can get to in the next couple of years. As you say, leveraging latent capacity in the workforce that's been created, or indeed training up people to bring them across to the clean energy sector at a time when we can really make some of those nation building investments. So Anna, back in April, ClimateWorks Australia released Decarbonisation Futures, a credible economy-wide pathway to net zero. I'm interested in what the key insights of that work were and how they can be harnessed for this particular moment we're facing at the moment, where we're charting a course for economic recovery.
the decarbonisation futures study that we did mapped Australia's pathways to net zero emissions by 2050, looking at staying under a 2 degrees trajectory and also a 1.5 degrees trajectory. And the key takeouts in relation to green recovery were the double dividend opportunity and need. So that is to do decarbonisation at the same time as economic stimulus and recovery. Obviously, I know that's the topic of this panel, and when we think about it, it looks like a no-brainer in the sense that actually when we looked at the research that was telling us what does Australia need to do to achieve net zero by 2050, which is now the new normal in terms of expectations of investors, of the business sector, all the state governments in Australia. And indeed, the new normal has also shifted that net zero trajectory goal from 2 degrees to 1.5 degrees. That's now the new global expectation of net zero asset owners and a raft of other benchmark setters. It's worth it. The difference between those two, it's exponential more damage in a 2 degree world than in a 1.5 degree world. So looking at that scenario, I think what we've found is perhaps not well understood is the sheer pace of deployment that's needed in the next decade. So to stay under a 1.5 degree trajectory, emissions in Australia need to be 3/4 less than what they are now in 10 years. So that's where the double dividend opportunity comes in. So the double dividend opportunity, when you think about the stimulus, is that when we looked at this research pre-COVID, as it was 2 years in the making, we saw the need to deploy at scale and at pace. And what do we have? The government stimulus budgets seeking to inject urgent capital and growth into the market. Not only do we need to go faster, but we actually have this opportunity where governments are leaning in and wanting to make their economies go faster in terms of construction in particular, long-lived assets while interest rates are low, and the decarbonisation goal. So the double dividend opportunity and need was one of the key takeouts. I think the other is breadth. This is the All Energy Conference, and there's often a talk about electricity, but actually our decarbonisation futures scenarios show the net zero emissions goal is economy-wide. It is an absolute goal. And as we've heard now, some of Australia's largest companies have adopted that goal, as has China now adopted a net zero by 2060 goal. Getting there means more than electricity. Australia's electricity emissions are about a third of overall emissions. So even if we achieve the 1.5 trajectory, which needs electricity to be above 70% in renewables, that is a great start, and it is an enabler of many other sectors. But let's look at those other sectors. We then looked at when you include electricity in the other sectors, buildings is about a fifth of total emissions. They too need to see emissions reduced by 3/4 in the next decade. So obviously the grid can help in decarbonising electricity for buildings, but it also means buildings using half the energy per square metre than they currently do. They can be so much more energy productive, and that needs to be part of the considerations for stimulus, because retrofitting buildings and improving the building stock, commercial and residential, is a great job creator. They are local, very, very local jobs, can't be outsourced to overseas offshore, and help the resilience of the homeowner in terms of the lower bills, as well as the comfort and the health outcomes. When we move to the other sectors, transport is also about a fifth of emissions nationally. And we've got to move really fast here just to stay still in terms of emissions in transport. It is one of the areas of rising emissions in Australia, which is of concern. Obviously, electrification is the decarbonisation path there. And what we see in our research is on a 1.5 degree trajectory, transport emissions are just over 10% lower in a decade. So we can see electricity emissions 70% lower and transport 10% lower. And that's with the same degree of effort. That's just a sense of how much harder it is in the transport sector. So how do we achieve that? We found that obviously electric vehicles in the car fleet is part of the story, but so it is in trucks, electric or fuel cell for zero emissions. And what we find is even just to have 10% saving in transport emissions in 10 years, EVs would have to be 3/4 of new car sales in 10 years, so that they're about 1/3 of the fleet. Trucks, are we talking about zero emissions truck sales yet? They would need to be 2/3 of all truck sales in 10 years for our emissions in trucks to be part of just bringing total transport fleet emissions down by 10%. So that would be about 1/4 of all trucks on the road being zero emissions in at the end of this decade, in 10 years. We can do it. We worked with CSIRO. The research shows it's possible. But what we need to see is the stimulus focus on achieving that. And that's where deployment comes in. Designing in demand pull signals, not just supply cost subsidies, but actually baking into procurement, not just obviously all government stimulus has a procurement element, but so can private investment bake in the procurement goals. And we've seen the minister talk really, really well about the success of VRET and baking in local content goals, for example. That's the mindset to be applied in all sectors beyond energy and electricity. Industry's half of emissions, and the O's emissions need to halve in a decade as well. So that's just a bit of a flavour, Luke, of the scale and the breadth of the decarbonisation challenge, but that of all the decades to face that challenge, arriving at the beginning of this decade with COVID challenge, we've got the opportunity to do the double dividend together. And if we miss this opportunity, we miss the whole decade. It's been said by the former head of the UNFCCC, we thought we had 10 years to accelerate the pace. We've really got 18 months. Because if we miss the COVID window for getting the double dividend from all new investment doing both jobs, decarbonising and stimulating, then that money has gone into the economy without reducing the economy's emissions, and we will not have enough of the decade left to achieve the 3/4 reduction in emissions. I hope that everyone listening can apply that in their own business and sector and ask what pathway you're on to see your sector and your company's emissions fall by 3/4 this decade.
Well, Anna, as I'd hoped, you've pretty effectively set up the burning platform from it for us. We have a task ahead of us, and to use this as an opportunity to create an inflection point in all of those different parts of the economy, an inflection point we need to create to be where we need to be in 2030, which is, as you say, not very far away. Eitan, when I hear about the kind of ambition that Anna is calling on us to show, I think of BZE's plan for creating well over 1 million low carbon jobs. It is very ambitious. It got a great deal of media coverage when it was released in July. As you've been, you know, talking to people across the community, you and your team, what is your sense of the public's appetite for embracing that vision that Anna's just laid out and making Australia's economic recovery a clean recovery?
Thanks, Luke, and thanks to everyone that's joining us here today. Back in March, when it was clear that we were heading into an economic crisis on the back of COVID, the Beyond Zero Emissions team got together and decided that we were going to put something up on the scale, you know, the response to the crisis on the scale of the crisis. You know, it seems, you know, we've been in financial crises before, and it always seemed the lesson out of those was the people that were ready with the plans on the table were more likely to have their plans funded. So we really wanted to make sure that there was an ambitious plan on the table. And I think the other thing that we've learned through those crises is that, you know, that we need economic stimulus to help economies recover. And good stimulus is all about accelerating trends that are already in place so that you're bringing forward jobs that were going to be created anyway in the future. But more importantly, because that means that you can bring private investment along for the ride with you, because private investment wants to invest in a trend that's moving forward. They don't want to invest in the past or things that are high risk. Basically we challenged ourselves to put together a plan that could show how we could create 1 million jobs through backing the trend towards decarbonisation through a lot of the initiatives that we've already talked about in this call. So things like accelerating the rollout of renewables, building retrofits, electrifying our transport, electrifying manufacturing and mining, and then also looking at land use and recycling. And we, before our big launch in July, we had a number of kind of briefings along the way talking about specific initiatives in there. And just from those briefings, I mean, they were really well attended. It was really clear that there was a huge amount of public support for the things that we and other groups were talking about. But I guess I was surprised that there was actually so much business and industry support. Like, we had the Business Council of Australia come out pretty early. Basically, every company, you know, big or small, superannuation funds, banks, everyone that we spoke to were like, we agree that this is the direction the economy should be going in. We might, you know, we could nitpick about individual things and individual plans, but the bigger thesis that we should be investing as a country towards decarbonisation as a response to COVID, that was kind of universally acclaimed. And now we've seen, you know, the BCA, ARG, the Farmers Federation, you know, basically almost unanimous support for that idea. So the BZA team, you know, I have to congratulate them. They worked bloody hard. You know, we launched the plan, and what we were really careful to do is that, you know, this is actually, because we're talking about jobs and the economy, this is a really great opportunity to put this frame of decarbonisation in front of a new audience, in front of a conservative audience potentially, because we're not talking as much about emissions, we're talking more about jobs and the economy, which is a more comfortable conversation for them. So the Million Jobs Plan got really good coverage in the conservative media, and that did open up the opportunity to have a conversation with the federal government and also with project proponents who were then attracted to that bigger vision. So we now have a database of over 700 projects around Australia that are all exemplars of the kinds of initiatives that we're talking about. And we, you know, based on a number of criteria, cut that down to a short list of 15 really good, you know, big, I guess, lighthouse projects that we presented to the federal government in the context of their budget deliberations. And you know, I know that those projects have been seriously considered in the budget process. We also engaged some independent economic analysis of the plan that's been really helpful, because it shows that doing something like this, you know, does have a material increase in employment, makes a difference to GDP, a significant difference to GDP and real wages. And because we're backing that trend and private investment's doing a lot of the work, it doesn't create a material increase in public spending relative to GDP. So I think all of these things have meant that, you know, the government, the federal government I'm talking about, because it's clear the state governments are kind of have been pretty onto this, you know, I think they do understand this more than they're letting on. You know, we've seen over $3.5 billion in funding announcements that you could say support a clean economic recovery being announced in the last few weeks. And if you're following the dollars strictly, you know, there's only been $28 million announced for gas and nothing for coal. So, you know, all the rhetoric aside, you'd have to say there is a shift there towards the kinds of things that we're talking about in the clean economic recovery, even if the rhetoric hasn't shifted as much as we'd like it to. And I think that's because, again, this is more comfortable ground for the government. They can be talking about jobs. They can be talking about the economy. The government has to do something about jobs. We all know there is huge opportunity here, and private investment is on board. And, you know, also this is what's happening internationally. Australia doesn't want to be snookered. China just announced net zero by 2060. You know, if Biden wins the election in America, my American friends tell me that, you know, that their team are kind of aware that in America, generally, if you win the Senate, you kind of lose it 2 years later. So, you know, his team are kind of pretty aware they've got 100 days basically to make the initiatives that they want to make, and they're going to go really hard. So things could change very, very fast. So again, I think we're seeing a step. You know, I think all of our efforts here, you know, ClimateWorks, the Climate Council, WWF, we've all put forward good plans. I think the government has made some good steps. We need to make it easy for them to kind of continue taking those steps forward. And I'm looking forward to seeing what's in the budget tonight. And, you know, we have to do it, because the opportunity for Australia is enormous. And the risks, if we don't do it, are just, you know, too terrible to think about. So let's keep it up. Kick it up.
I think you make a really good point, Eitan, around the global context and how fluid it is at the moment with the presidential election, because everyone's just throwing up their hands at this point and going, who the hell knows what's going to happen? But a Biden election win is at least very plausible at this point, at which point you've got the European Union with a very clear commitment in this space. You've got the US with a very clear commitment in the space. And even in the last couple of weeks, China committing to net zero emissions by 2060. And so, you know, we've been able to keep our head down over the last few years while attention is focused on recalcitrance in other parts of the world, particularly in the US, I guess. But we might not have that opportunity for very much longer, and it would behoove us to consider some of the ways that we could get with the momentum globally, I think, Eitan. Ian, I'm very conscious that you're hanging out with a bunch of advocates here, a banker among a bunch of advocates, and I want to put you at your ease. We're not going to ask you too many hard questions, but we did catch up on our podcast a few weeks ago, and we had this sort of broad discussion about a clean recovery, and you effectively said, look, you know, the CFC wants to play its role. And given that there's a bit more clarity about the federal government's position on the role of the CFC and ARENA and those sorts of institutions after the last 2 or 3 weeks, I'm sort of interested in you sharing with us how you see that role evolving, and particularly over the next couple of years as we work our way out of this economic crisis.
Thanks, Luke. And the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, I see, and I know the government see, and I'm sure many stakeholders and people on this, on this conference line would agree. I think you have a really important role to play in the recovery, very important role. And, you know, I think a lot of the principles that the CFC has held dearly over its kind of 8 years in existence, which is, you know, kind of filling in market gaps, crowding in private sector investment, you know, taking risks that others aren't prepared, the private sector aren't yet prepared to take, as well as kind of looking right across the economy and seeing how it can decarbonise more broadly the economy, I think are principles that will continue to hold dear to us as we go into the recovery, and seeing how we can use our capital, importantly, to help to help with this, to come out of the pandemic and stimulate the economy. Just sort of kind of reminding the world that, you know, we've got $10 billion at the CEFC, and that's before, we'll talk about the Grid Reliability Fund in a minute. So we've got $10 billion, and that's, quite a lot of capital for both debt and equity to invest right across the clean energy sector. So not just renewables, but, of course, energy efficiency. And I know, Luke, you'd be pleased to hear that. And, today we've committed $6 billion of the 10. We've got about $4.6 billion actually out the door in the, sort of 200 or so transactions that we've done. So there's still plenty of capital there. There's still plenty of firepower, if you like. And we've got to a stage of maturity, and because about 85% of our investments are debt, because about the stage that we're at, we're getting back now about as much as we're putting out the door. So last year we got back $942 million in kind of repayments, or, we recycled some of our projects. We sold our investments in some cases where we felt we'd already achieved the carbon abatement required. So we got back nearly $1 billion as we put out the door $1 billion. So that means that, we've kind of reach the steady state. So, we're getting capital back, we can redeploy, as well as, we've got a lot of headroom there. So that's important, and that's, I think that's obviously critical. We've had and continue to invest, of course, very actively in the renewable energy sector, and we've invested about in something like 3 gigawatts of renewables, and we will continue to do that on a strategic basis. But the government, of course, have, and alongside our thinking has evolved, of course, for some time. Is, where do we turn our attention, and where does the CEFC look to kind of make that difference? It doesn't need to necessarily play in very mature technology. Doesn't need to, we certainly don't want to be there if others, commercial lenders or institutional capital, wants to play there. So where do we go next? And a couple of things that's probably worth touching on is to talk about the grid and the Grid Reliability Fund, and of course the technology roadmap. We hear a lot about the technology roadmap and where it's kind of directing CFC and ARENA to go. So the Grid Reliability Fund is, at the moment, it's draft legislation. It's been introduced into Parliament, and there is a Senate committee having a look at that. And it effectively would give us a further $1 billion to invest in a kind of a range of things related to, of course, improving the kind of security and reliability of the grid. Now, we have been focused on that area for some time. So it's certainly not kind of new territory for us, but it's you know, very welcome that we get a further $1 billion and a great, you know, vote of confidence again from the government and the CEFC. So that $1 billion, if you look at the draft legislation, talks about, you know, about storage, transmission and distribution, and generally investments that will improve the reliability and security of the grid. And you know, the sort of things that you might expect that we'll look at is, you know, large-scale storage transactions, pump storage, although, you know, that is a challenging sector. We'd love some further projects in that area to get up. We've got Snowy 2.0, and well, there's transmission and distribution related to that that we're working on, and we hope to make announcements in relation to that soon. And of course, interconnection, both, you know, across from Victoria across to Tasmania with Marinus, very important bit of infrastructure that would unlock the battery of the nation, as well as interconnection between other states, which will, of course, help with the grid, which has been such a challenge over the last 18 months nearly 2 years, with this, you know, huge uptake of renewables and a very slow upgrade of the grid. And we heard Lily talk about, you know, she very clearly understands the different speeds at which renewables get built out relative to the grid and the challenges that is placing on renewables. So the Grid Reliability Fund, yep, looking forward to that making its way through. But in the meantime, as I say, still actively looking at investments in renewable energy zones, transmission, and anything that we can to improve the situation with the grid. The technology roadmap. Now, a couple of weeks ago, the government came out, Minister Taylor, with the annual kind of statement of the priority technologies and the low emissions technology statement, I think, as it's referred to, and it identified the key areas of which the government wants to focus, and they would like us, therefore, and ARENA to focus, which of course is hydrogen, soil sequestration, green steel, green aluminium, and large scale storage in preferably 8 hours or greater. I haven't mentioned carbon capture and storage. Of course, that was another technology that was announced in the tech statement the other day. Today, the CEFC is precluded from investing in carbon capture and storage. The government has some designs on changing that. So we'll see down the track as that may unfold. And if that was the case, then, you know, if there were carbon capture and storage projects in Australia, then they would potentially ones that we would look at. In the industrial sector, the talk of green steel, green aluminium, absolutely, or very interested in that area. You know, industry, huge emitter. If Australia can drive down the cost of those particular products, those commodities, because once again, they've got to compete with the conventional ones that are already out there. So they will need support from people like us and ARENA to kind of get them, get those players, steel manufacturers here in Australia. We've seen some deals or some potential opportunities, also in green cement, another very substantial emitter. So whether or not those processes start to get run with renewable energy, or in fact we can change the way that they're producing steel and introducing green hydrogen, taking out other fossil fuels in that process. You know, that's the challenge that we're going to be working on over the coming years. So lots of very exciting things for us that we'll be investing in over the next coming years. But the energy efficiency side of our portfolio, of course, we're not leaving that behind. We've been supporting green mortgages and green consumer loans and point of sale loans. through your partners like Bank Australia and many intermediaries that we work with. We created a green bond fund this year, and we also created a hybrid bond and a climate index investment product, and with the help of ClimateWorks, very pleased to say, the use of their Australian Climate Transition Index, which when you make this investment, not only you're largely exposed to a green bond, but there's a component of it which is exposed to ASX 300 companies, but only the ones that are best equipped for the transition. So a very exciting first step in trying to introduce financial products and investments, giving people exposure to the sort of leaders in this climate transition on the ASX here in Australia. And that got huge amount of interest right across the world. It was even got name checked in the New York Times of all places. So there's lots of exciting things happening here in Australia, and the CFC is really pleased to be part of it, and look forward to making substantial investments as part of this transition over the coming 12 months.
It's clear that the CFC has been a lot on, and there's a lot on the agenda for the next couple of years, particularly on strategic investments in some of those hard to abate sectors and some of those emerging technologies that, as you say, we need to drive the costs down, and will be incredibly important as we get into the latter half of this decade.
First Fuel is brought to you by the Energy Efficiency Council, a not-for-profit membership association for businesses, universities, governments, and NGOs. The Council's mission is to unlock the potential of energy efficiency to deliver healthy, comfortable buildings, productive, competitive businesses, and an affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy system for Australia. To find out how your organisation can get involved, visit eec.org.au/membership.
Kane, I'm going to throw to you. I want to, if you will, just play the role of a budget commentator for a moment. We've got no shortage of ideas that have been laid out today. We've got a clear sense of urgency, which Anna has given us. The opportunity is huge, whether you're talking about jobs or productivity benefits or the ability of the sectors that we represent to sort of hit the ground really quickly and have an impact and replace some of those jobs that have been lost over the last little while. But what are you sensing in terms of the political appetite? My sense, at least at the state level, is that there's a lot of strong support from across the political spectrum. Perhaps you can comment on that, and if that's your sense as well. But also, where you think things might be landing at the federal level in terms of tonight's budget and beyond.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. I feel like that's the hardest topic of the lot, isn't it? Look, I think it's worth acknowledging up front that the politics of energy and climate have moved, I think, quite dramatically in the last, say, 12 months in particular here in Australia. And, we've heard from other speakers, the level of broad support for, however you describe it, a cleaner recovery from COVID-19 is pretty overwhelming. If you look at what's happening globally across the business sector, leading businesses, community groups, you name it, I think what we've been talking about over the last hour or so is now just so broadly and widely accepted. And I think that has fundamentally changed the politics now and no doubt into the future. I guess if we reflect on what's happened in terms of the COVID-19 response, it's been pretty significant. Everyone has a plan, and we released ours called A Clean Recovery about 6 months ago now. It's been a long 6 months when you reflect on what's transpired over that period. But if we sort of do a bit of a stop take as to what's been progressed over that time, it's pretty significant. And A Clean Recovery had about a dozen different measures and areas for government to focus to ensure that the momentum that had started to be lost in renewable energy was regained. And it's worth noting, we obviously had an unprecedented sort of 2017-18, but things were starting to slow, particularly on the utility scale end of the market. Now, that says there's enormous opportunity. Our analysis says there's well over 100 large-scale wind, solar and battery projects essentially ready to go. They could create in the order of 50,000 jobs very, very quickly, particularly in rural and regional parts of the country. I think it's worth acknowledging that the role of government has shifted over the years, and that's because of the extraordinary success of the renewable energy sector. The economics have changed very fundamentally, and so we're no longer asking just for big fat subsidies and large amounts of capital. There's enormous international and domestic investor appetite to invest in renewable energy. So the role of government, I think Anna made the point, there is still a role for government as far as the market pull. But increasingly, that's actually about government getting out of the way and setting some clear market signals. But there's also a big role for government in terms of that sort of facilitation and also the reform agenda. And again, when we reflect on a clean recovery and those dozen or so initiatives that we put forward, there's a lot to be pleased about over the past 6 months, both from state and territory governments, and I think it's recognised they've really been at the forefront of this. But if you just do a quick stock take, and we've covered quite a few of these areas already, but we've had the Tasmanian government commit to become 200% renewable energy by 2040. We've got the WA government driving hydrogen hubs. We've got New South Wales pushing very hard on renewable energy zones. We've heard from the Victorian minister talking about strengthening the grid and further rounds of VRET. We've had a lot of focus on transmission. It's unfortunate and frustrating that didn't happen 10 years ago because that's a real issue now and it has very long lead times. But there is a lot of focus. And I expect, Luke, to your question about tonight's budget, I think we'll see clearly, we're going to see a lot more focus on infrastructure, and I expect and hope that transmission is a key element of that, and recognise that transmission infrastructure is nation building and critical for our long term future. I don't think we've had mention of ARENA as yet. We've had $1.6 billion committed to extend ARENA for another decade, and I think I touched on the reform agenda. Reform to the grid and the energy market is the single most biggest challenge and most important initiative for the large-scale renewable energy sector. And the good news is that it's happening at unprecedented levels. The better news is that it's not necessarily a political exercise. It's a complex regulatory reform at arm's length from some of the silliness of politics that we've seen over the last decade. But that reform is well underway, and almost every day we see another reform that takes us forward in terms of creating us a 21st century energy system. So I guess that's my way of saying there's a lot to be pleased about. There's a whole lot more to do, and I think some of those announcements are pretty modest when you look at comparatively what's happening around the world. But they're a good start. I expect tonight we'll probably see more of what we've seen over the past couple of weeks, which is rhetoric that's probably fairly heavy on gas, but actual substance that's consistent with what we've been discussing today and what the Australian people and business community now want and expect. And I think sometimes we just need to, is there a headline referring to Trump in the last 24 hours, which is ignore the fireworks and focus on the substance. And I expect that's probably what we'll need to do a little bit of tonight. But make no mistake, the transition is underway. It's happening faster than it's ever happened before, and it's unstoppable, and there'll still be media headlines and political rhetoric and games that are frustrating and unhelpful, but the substance is pointing in one direction. I think some of the organizations and individuals we've heard from in the last hour should be proud of their contribution in helping that. And, you know, we've got a long way to go, but we're pointing in the right direction.
I might go to you, Amanda. We've heard ATERN is been engaging with the government through BZE and feeling optimistic. Kane's, broadly optimistic about the trajectory of the federal government. Is that where you are at the Climate Council in terms of saying, well, there's a lot of talk of things like a gas lead recovery, but actually when you follow the money, it's going in productive directions?
I think Kane's right. There has been a big change in the last few years, and that's been amplified this year as the COVID response has occurred. I think the biggest change earlier this year was on the rhetoric from coal to gas. Coal is barely receives a mention these days, whereas the gas-led recovery is obviously a big part of the rhetoric and story. There hasn't been a huge amount of money put behind that yet, but we'll see what's in the budget tonight. I think that will reveal how serious the government is about a gas-led recovery, or if it's sort of part of the edges of the story, if you like. But there is, the government has said one of the priority areas will be clean energy in the budget. So let's see what transpires. I think what's important, though, is to also look at the state governments and what their COVID recovery will look like. And the state governments have been more quietly leading on climate change now for many years. And, they all have net zero targets by 2050. Most of them have renewable energy targets, and the ones that don't, like New South Wales, for instance, does have a range of different policies. Their renewable energy zones that they've announced have been important, etc. So I think there is a lot of action going on in the states. When you work on climate change, I think it's easy to feel pretty disheartened a lot of the time, particularly as the climate change impacts are so extreme around us, particularly the last summer here in Australia with the bushfires. But I think it's very helpful to look backwards and say, how far have we come? And when you look back a decade, there's been a major transformation. So we have to anticipate that scale of change is only accelerating into the future. And I think what ATERN said earlier about things are changing very quickly and actually they could change even more quickly is for those advocates like myself, thinking, how do you stay ahead of what's coming? And I think Kane was wise to say, what's the noise versus what's the substance? And trying to identify what is the substance and how you stay ahead of that to push the envelope. Because as Anna said earlier, the window of time for solutions is actually very short on climate change. We've delayed decades too long. The science keeps, every time there's a new iteration of the science, it's worse than what we thought it would be. The impacts are happening much more quickly than we thought. And so the action that's required has to accelerate very dramatically.
Mm-hmm. I think that's probably one of the challenges in this space is that we can be optimistic and constructive and say, well, we're moving in the right direction, but at the same time we need to, going to the title of this session, massively accelerate action in that space. And so holding that tension in our roles is obviously a challenge. When I reflect on that rhetoric around a gas-led recovery, I note what everybody's saying around, not much money's gone into it. My concern is that it sort of fills a space in the debate which precludes money going into other more productive directions. Also note that, in just on the pure stimulus front, jobs hitting the economy in the next sort of 18 months, that what we need to do it to get the country back on track, it doesn't quite add up in my head, because this is not a sector with a big jobs multiplier. Even if you look at a vision for the manufacturing sector, which would see it massively expand over time, that's something that will take years to develop. And so I'm a little bit skeptical on the gas-led recovery thing. But Anna, do you have anything to add to that on the climate front?
Sure. I mean, I think the important thing to remember about gas is that gas is in transition to a zero emissions fuel. In the previous decade, there was a lot of discussion about gas as the transition fuel. But now that net zero emissions is the new normal expectation, the understanding then is that there are three decades to eliminate all emissions from all of the economy. So that's where the green hydrogen work is very important. It's where carbon capture and storage potentially plays a role, but it has fundamentally changed the way we look at gas. So any new investment in gas, particularly to satisfy private investors, will need an explanation for what is its pathway to zero emissions. Now, it's not impossible to have a zero emissions gas energy source, but it's very different from unabated natural gas extraction. In addition, there are new studies coming out about methane leakage assessments from natural gas and those estimates proving to be much greater than previously revealed. And so both of those are creating constraints on and certainly increased risk in relation to investing in gas as what Australians discuss gas as unabated fossil fuel gas. I think that's the number one message to remember is that I do think it's pretty palpable in the last year and a bit, if we're discussing pace of change, how quickly net zero emissions has become a more normalised planning framework.
And Anna, you mentioned carbon capture and storage. It's obviously been one of the more contentious elements of the federal government's plans that have been released over the last 2 or 3 weeks. But could you sort of unpack for us, you know, to what degree that's got a role, and if it does have a role, which sectors it's likely to play a part?
Our research, as with many others globally, shows that at the moment CCS is still needed on, particularly for industry decarbonisation and potentially for future what's called negative emissions, so helping us remove further carbon from the atmosphere, for example, such as bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. But what's really important around understanding the pace of change is to be very targeted about the investment work in relation to CCS, and that any new support for CCS not be at the expense of the race to decarbonise, particularly the electricity sector. So, for example, we support an increased mandate for public investment institutions such as the CFC and ARENA to explore CCS on the sectors where it is needed, in particular in industry. But if you've got an increased mandate, then it needs increased funding, because we are not yet on track for the sectors that are currently within the mandate. But certainly until there is a substitute for some of the emissions that we do not yet know how to eliminate, so that's in relation to use of cement, for example, and the decade between now and when hydrogen might be a substitute, for example, in steel and other heavy industry, there is a need for CCS. And we don't have, in climate terms, we don't have that decade to wait for a breakthrough invention. So at the moment, there is a residual need for CCS, not in electricity, but in the unabated industrial emissions, and that's where the investment should be focused, in addition to the investment in decarbonisation of all the other technologies that we already know can leapfrog straight to a zero emissions solution.
You make a really good point about the scale of funding required to move the needle in some of these areas, like Kane and the Clean Energy Council. We were really pleased with the government's announcement around ARENA in particular, and the forward funding for that. But there are some really big agenda items in that technology roadmap, and I'm not sure that the scale of funding that has been provided to date, noting that the government has committed to top it up from time to time, is necessarily going to be equal to the task. I suppose that's something that we can continue to push on. But Ian, did you want to add anything on the CCS conversation?
The government has, in that recent technology statement, has made a kind of an observation, or a target, effectively a stretch target, to get carbon capture and storage in terms of its cost down to $20 a ton. And that's the sort of the challenge, isn't it? Because with industry generation, with emitters, to kind of retrofit a particular process with what could be 100 million, a very substantial investment, they're only going to do that if there is a business case. That might be being rewarded through the Emissions Reduction Fund. I know the King Review looked at expanding scope of the ERF might be under the Climate Solution Fund name, where CCS would be included in there. So you kind of need some revenue stream, something that's going to justify that investment of capital, because, you know, otherwise it's you know, it's a capital expense. So that you know, it's those sorts of things that are going to be very determinative in the success of CCS in this country.
I might throw to you, Aitan. We've got a question from the audience around involving the Australian community in the investment opportunity, not wanting to put UEN out of a job. We have a question here around transitioning people from being consumers to stakeholders as a way of scaling up investments to meet the scale of the energy transition, opening up investment opportunities to mums and pops. I note that your plan, Aitan, sort of included some fairly out-of-the-box thinking about how some of this transition might be funded. Do you want to speak to some of that?
Yeah, well, I think particularly, you know, when you're talking about the community and investing, you know, one of the easiest ways that communities can get involved in the transmission is through their own houses. So obviously there's schemes and you know, people across Australia have understood the benefit of putting solar on their houses and the payback times, you know, that it really is an economic, you know, you can consider it an investment both in the value of your home and the long term, lowering your energy bills long term. But one of the things that we talk about in the Million Jobs Plan is really scaling that up and retrofitting 2.5 million homes in Australia over the next 5 years to the point where they have effectively zero energy bills. And, you know, we've looked at schemes around the world. You know, France have a target to retrofit 500,000 homes a year. And there is in various European countries schemes that allow private capital to get involved. So rather than a homeowner putting up that entire cost, you know, which could be say $15,000 to $30,000 to really can electrify your home and get it to a point where it's not generating much energy bills, because all of that cost is up front and then the paybacks over time, that really opens itself up to financial innovation. So you have schemes in Europe where you sign up to basically have your home almost as a managed energy unit. So you pay no upfront cost. The company comes and puts the solar in the batteries, does the energy efficiency improvements, lowers, say your energy bill was $500 before, maybe afterwards it works out to about $100, and you agree to pay $300 a month to the company that's done the fitment for you with no upfront cost. So, you know, you've got an energy saving, the company gets its payback from the difference between your new energy bill and what the consumer's paying you. And then after a while it's paid back, you know, the homeowner has the increased value to their home and the lower energy bills forever. And so that means that's a way to kind of do these things on a big scale with private investment and without the government having to stump up all of, you know, the billions of dollars that it would take to do it. And that's what's so exciting. And that's the reason we're starting to see this exponential growth in change across so many sectors, is because, you know, the economics are now coming into line. You know, we're hearing about similar schemes now with electric vehicles where you get the car for free as long as you kind of bundle that in with your home management services in various countries. So, you know, I think we're looking at that mobile phone-atization of so many different parts of our life going forward, because when you have a paradigm where there's very low ongoing costs but just an upfront cost, you know, we can finance these things in really interesting ways. And I'm sure Ian and CFC are looking at a lot of them.
Kane, I'm just sort of reflecting on all the things we've covered in today's conversation, which we're going to have to wrap up at the moment. If I can almost bin them in three ways, and I want to test this thinking with you. There's sort of like, there's the short-term stuff and this moment that Anna's pointed to around, you know, driving an inflection point in the transition across a whole bunch of industries, which is about, you know, judiciously applying money to issues that we know that we have to deal with and that can hit the ground very, very quickly. And there's these longer term issues around things like regulatory reform and certainty around climate policy, which will just assist the private sector in making smart decisions around, you know, how we transition things like, you know, the replacement of generation assets that we know we've got a whole bunch of them that are about to hit end of life. And then we've got this other bucket, which Ian's focused on with the new remit, which is like the new technologies that we're going to need in the back half of this decade, you know, starting to drive the cost down, starting to understand how it even works in cases where we don't necessarily have all the answers. And we need to be doing those three things simultaneously now. Is that kind of the message?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that's a good summary. And clearly we have no time to waste. And I think sometimes my frustrations are that we do waste times on different kind of distractions. One of my real bugbears is the number of inquiries this country has had into nuclear power. I'm not attending any more nuclear power inquiries. We're not writing any more submissions because every time we do, it distracts us from how do we accelerate the technologies that are here right now that are already proven that we know can decarbonize the country. And I think what you've outlined is a good way to think about the different elements of what we need to do. I think we're in a pretty good position. I think, just the wisdom we've heard from in the last hour, I think demonstrates there's a lot of pretty sophisticated thinking. There's a lot for us to be pleased about as far as the foundation, the momentum. We just need to hasten a little more quickly and do it in a more coordinated way. And I think there's some obligation I think there on our political leaders. Some of them are doing that. Some of them have got room to improve, and also put some obligation on organisations, the likes of which are represented here today, to think about the role that we play. How do we work together? How do we sustain ourselves? And how do we accelerate the transition?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't think of a better way to close. Kane, Anna, Amanda, Eitan, and Ian, thanks for an incredible conversation and your ongoing leadership in this space. We agree with Kane. We're lucky to have the passion and the intellectual horsepower you'll bring to your work now more than ever, because we need to work together to keep building momentum for a clean recovery. So we all look forward to hearing the plans of state and federal governments as they rolled out tonight and over coming months. I want to thank everyone on the line for being with us today. To be a part of more great sessions just like this one, you can check out allenergy.com.au and energyefficiencyexpo.com.au. There is a veritable cornucopia of content being live streamed in lieu of a physical event this year. And of course, we all look forward to seeing you in person again in 2021. But for now, it is a goodbye from us. Stay safe, and we'll catch you soon.